Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. I'll be chatting with Catherine Boyd from Studio by the Tracks. Tell me a little bit about Studio by the Tracks.
Okay. Studio by the Tracks is a nonprofit art studio, which started in 1989. And we provide free art classes to adults with autism spectrum disorder. And we also have two classes of children who are living in a group home who've been removed from their home, and they're emotionally conflicted children. And we have one class of adults, homeless men with mental illness. But most of our classes are adults on the autism spectrum.
So, do you use any modified teaching methods for these individuals?
You know, our structure is very loose. We aren't truly art therapists. We don't have, our degrees vary from social work to art education to psychology. So our teaching is actually fairly loose. Sometimes it's more facilitating because our students have such varying levels of functioning. Some of them come here and use art class as really a studio space. They have their ideas about what they want to do. They get their own supplies, and they might ask us here and there some questions about technique or things, but they're really kind of good to go on their own. And then other students are more, you know, less independent, I suppose, and they're more, they require more attention, they require more thought on our part as to exactly what projects might suit them. A big part of our job is to try to come up with new ideas to encourage our students to grow creatively. People on the autism spectrum often find comfort in repetition, drawing the same things over and over. Many of them have an area of restricted interest. For instance, we have one student whose interest is the Byzantine Catholic Church. So if it were up to him, he would draw icons of saints all day, every day. That's all he would ever do. And we do let him do a lot of that, but we're always trying to encourage him to maybe try it a little bit differently or look at this style of icon just to grow creatively a little bit. And also, because another function that we serve is that we do sell the artwork. Our students don't pay to come here, and we have two events a year where we sell, and at our biggest event, 500 people attend it, so it's very well attended. People pay in the hundreds and occasionally in the thousands for the artwork. And our students receive 60% of whatever we sell the artwork for. So there is, you know, an incentive there, especially for some of our students, a financial incentive to make money. Many of our students aren't able to hold jobs, and so it can be a great source of income. And even for our students who don't have really a sense of money, for them a check for $10 wouldn't be that different from a check for $100 or even, say, $1,000. Just that validation and the recognition and knowing that their artwork was sold, and many of our students attend our our shows, and so they're able to stand there and watch someone buying their painting or bidding on their painting, and it's very exciting. And it's a sense of validation that many of these people have not really received in their lives because they don't have traditional strengths. They haven't necessarily been admitted and awarded throughout their lives. So raising that visibility and is another one of the things that we do here.
So, in your time with Studio by the Tracks, is there any one success moment that stands out for you?
Well, I guess I'm going to... Yes, we have many success moments throughout the day. Oftentimes with people with autism, success can be so gradual and cover the span of so many years that it can be hard to pinpoint. But I guess I would just tell the story of one of our students named Michael, who started coming here when it was first formed 25 years ago. And when he would first come here, he would only draw the Peanuts cartoon characters, Snoopy, Charlie Brown. And that's all he would do. And he was a rather somewhat angry, a little bit volatile student. And so we didn't push him too much. Over the course of the time that he's been here, he slowly began to trust us and slowly began to trust his environment enough to try new things, which is sometimes a huge obstacle to people with autism, to try new things and get out of their comfort zone. And so at this point, he will now draw anything we ask him to. There is absolutely not one thing that he would not draw in his paintings. He's particularly interested in peacocks, and every year we have him paint one big peacock painting for our annual benefit. And in fact, one year we used that image as our invitation image. He's also very afraid of crowds, and so he's never wanted to attend our annual benefit because of the people and the noise and that sort of thing. Well, 2 years ago when we used his peacock image on our invitation, he decided that he wanted to come to the event, and he went out and bought himself a new suit, and he walked up onto the stage where our longtime former director was up there introducing him, and he stood there as his peacock painting was auctioned off for over $1,000, and it would be hard for people in the audience to have appreciated just how remarkable it was that he was even in attendance and that he had painted this painting. But for those of us who've known him for years, it was really emotional.
So if you could send any one message about the need for disability inclusion in the arts, what would it be?
Well, the one thing that I would say, what we are seeing on the front lines here where we are in Birmingham, Alabama, which is the explosion of diagnosis rates for autism, means that as these children grow up and age out of the public school system, which here in America is at age 21, so they've gone from a school system and funding, which allows for all types of services, therapists, behavioral therapists, speech therapists, so many services, and then when they turn 21, they're let go from that system. So here, what we're seeing locally in Birmingham, and I can only imagine it's true all over, is that these now young adults have nothing. Many of them have nothing to do. Many of them are able to work, but some of them aren't, and so they lack. They lack social interaction because they're in their homes. Many of them would just as soon sit home and watch TV as do anything. So what we're finding is that there is a great need for a place to go and be with other like-minded people, a place of acceptance, a place of creative nurturing, and also a place to receive some validation and maybe even make a little money. I think that if we can nurture those abilities that already are there, certainly people with autism spectrum disorders and other disabilities are no different than the regular population, which is that many of them possess wonderful innate creative abilities, but that just need to be fostered. And so that's part of why we are here, which is to foster those abilities that already exist. They just need to be nurtured in a safe and accepting space. And the rewards of that work are astounding, both personally for the staff. They're wonderful rewards for the students. And I can't tell you how many parents we have had say to us, thank you so much for being a place that my child can go. Thank you for validating them. Some of these parents have not really received those types of validation for their children before. And just also to see their child earning a paycheck or selling a painting is just a wonderful, it's just a wonderful reward for all of us.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
The work of Studio by the Tracks is amazing, in so much as it's not just giving monetary gain to a person with a disability. It's a chance for them to express themselves through their art, to add to the cultural tapestry of the artistic community. That really is an amazing gift for a person with a disability who spends a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of effort in their art. Fact is, there's no disability anywhere that can damage a person's soul, their gift, to reach out from the things that are important to them. A person with a disability has just as much potential to inspire and to create as anyone else in society. And giving them a chance to express this through art, something that can have a meaningful and lasting impact. No two people are going to view the art in the same way. If it's something that impacts them, it makes no difference that it's coming from someone with a disability. The potential to inspire and to bring joy is the same. Potential to say, a creative soul with talent created this. Whether they have a disability or not, the only question in art that matters is, did it have an impact? And for these works, being guided and supported by Studio by the Tracks, I would say the answer is a resounding yes. They are having an impact on the community. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Hiatus House is a social service agency offering confidential intervention for families experiencing domestic violence, including the Crisis Intervention Program, Residential Program, Transitional and Housing Support Program, Crossroads Program, Fresh Start Men's Program, Fresh Start Women's Program City, Fresh Start Women's Program Country, and the Hiatus House School-Based Program. If you are interested or for more information, please contact us. Call us at 519-252-7781 or visit our website at www.hiatushouse.com or come to our location at 250 Lewis Avenue, Windsor. Contact Hiatus House. Get safe. Get help.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Catherine Boyd from Studio by the Tracks. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Mike McGowan from NOAA. Tell me a little bit about NOAA.
NOAA is a genetic support group for people who have albinism and the parents of children who have albinism. Our mission is to provide information and support, and we do that by bringing people in the albinism community together at conferences and camps, and we do quite a bit of distributing information through various means, website, a quarterly magazine. We've published about a dozen information bulletins, and we've published two parent books to help parents that have children with albinism deal with some of the issues related to the condition.
So, how does albinism typically affect a person?
There are several genes. There's over 15 genes that have been identified that cause some form of albinism, and albinism is broken down basically into about three subcategories. Oculocutaneous albinism affects the skin, the hair, and the eyes. The genetic change causes there to be a reduction or a complete absence of melanin pigment. And what that does is it changes the color of the hair to being from very platinum blonde to platinum white to blonde. The impact on the skin is the same. The skin is very much lighter than it would be for the ethnicity or race of the individual affected. And the reduction of pigment or the lack of pigment in the retina causes uncorrectable low vision. There is another type of albinism, that ocular albinism, that affects just the eye. So skin and hair pigmentation is the same for the race or ethnicity, but the eyesight is, that uncorrectable low vision is manifest in that particular gene. And then there are several genes that cause other metabolic disorders. There are two types, Chetty-Hakagashi syndrome, which involves an immune deficiency, so you have oculocutaneous albinism and an immune system problem. And then there's the Hermansky-Pudlak syndrome, which there are a number of genes, 9 or 10 genes that have been identified that deal with Hermansky-Pudlak syndrome. And the additional metabolic disorders can be a slight bleeding problem, Crohn's-like symptoms with inflammatory bowel problems, and in the most severe cases of HPS, there is pulmonary fibrosis, which can lead to death.
So, the information that NOAA presents to the albinism community, can you give me an overview of that?
Well, we have a website that we're in the process of reworking that provides a great deal of information about albinism and links to ways where you can communicate, people within the albinism community can communicate. We've published 10 to 12 information bulletins that address specific subtopics of albinism, for example, low vision driving or sun protection with albinism, or one of the bulletins talks about how a person with albinism sees, because the uncorrectable low vision is not like a refractive error where if you put the right lens in front of the eye, you can correct the vision. It's more complicated than that. And we've published 2 parent books. One is Raising a Child with Albinism, A Guide to the Early Years, and it covers birth through school age. And that particular book talks about dealing with the diagnosis, what type of early intervention services are appropriate for a child with albinism. It explains, more in depth about the genetics of the condition. And the second book, which was just published in July of last year, is Raising a Child with Albinism, A Guide to the School Years. And it covers from pre-K through transition. There's a number of chapters in there that address specific topics, again, like low vision driving, the IEP process, or the individual education plan. I'm not sure what the Canadian equivalent of that is, but in the United States, there is a federal law that mandates that children with disabilities be given accommodations to put them on as close to an even footing with their sighted or non-disabled peers as possible. those are basically what is a summary of what we do. Oh, I'm sorry, in a quarterly magazine that we publish. And the quarterly magazine is kind of a potpourri of different subjects that are related to the albinism community. We have opinion pieces where people write about their experiences living with the condition. We talk about news in the albinism community, and we talk about events that NOAA is sponsoring, and we banner in some articles about developments in science and medicine as well as technology.
So, in your time with NOAA, is there any one success moment that stands out for you?
One of the, I think, most successful things that we've done was in 2006 when The Da Vinci Code was released as a movie. The movie was based on this wildly successful bestseller by Dan Brown. And the story involved a stereotypic evil albino character. There was this monk assassin in the plot of the book who was depicted as having albinism. And when Brown wrote the book, he used the term albino something like 60 or 70 times in the book. And the issue that NOAA deals with, or with the albinism community deals with, is that in the history of motion pictures, there has been no realistic or sympathetic portrayal of a person with albinism. The characters are often just depicted as supernatural, having magical powers, and in most cases, evil. In this particular case, the character was most certainly evil. The issue we brought to the filmmakers was the company that made it was Ron Howard's company, Imagine, and we petitioned them to not change the character, not change the storyline, just in the movie to change the appearance of Silas the evil albino monk, to combat the myths and misconceptions about albinism. The studio didn't listen to us at all, and they cast the character and portrayed as it was written by Brown. Brown was supportive of us, and he at least said that he had talked to the studio about changing the character, but it went nowhere. But when the film was released, there was a great deal of controversy about it because of the plot line dealt with the Catholic Church and this idea of a secret society. And so there was a lot of controversy and some protest when the film went out. Well, we took the opportunity to get our message out that, you know, we weren't protesting the film. We were just calling attention to the fact that at that point in time, there had been no realistic portrayals of albinism in the media and in generally in popular culture. And we were just calling attention. We took the opportunity to call attention to it. We got all kinds of press on that. And it was, I think, a high watermark for us in terms of our advocacy. The impact, and the reason that I think that this was so important, is that the impact was pretty dramatic. If you, there's a fellow by the name of Dr. Vale Reese. He is a dermatologist in San Francisco, and he is interested in the depiction of hair and skin conditions in movies. And he has a website called Skinema. And he had done a survey that had shown that there were something like 65 or 70 movies that had the evil albino character up until about the time that this movie, the Da Vinci Code, came out. And he had noted that in the 80s and the 90s and in the first 5 years of the 2000s, that each decade, the number of evil albino character movies roughly doubled. But after our PR campaign, the number of movies that had the evil albino character dropped off dramatically. So that's why we think that we had a very positive impact, and we think that Hollywood listened to us.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
I find it absolutely fascinating that a disability group such as NOAA would take a chance on getting their message out there in a way that coincides with something mainstream, something so widely accepted and widely regarded. I think when you look at films, music, art, culture in general, from a disability standpoint, you get more of a perspective, get a deeper appreciation for it. One of our favorite guests here at the show, Stephanie Craig, was on a while back talking about disabilities in theater, the portrayal of a character with a disability who does not have one, difficulties therein, and the converse side of that. Portraying a character without a disability when one has one. But if you look these days at almost any film, disabilities are in the forefront. If you look at the X-Men franchise, for example, one of the lead characters is in a wheelchair. Now, granted, that was based on a comic, but the idea remains the same. Disabilities being portrayed as people of strength and integrity and intelligence. And that was what I think NOAA was trying to get across when they made their petition in regards to the albino character. It is a condition that can seriously affect a person. However, portraying the fact that someone with a condition can be any type of person is important. Truth is, disability affects all aspects of a person's life to a varying degree, that's true, but any person with a disability has the same potential to live for good or for not so good. It depends on the person, their value system, what matters to them. They all have the same potentials, hopes, dreams. Each one, if given the right opportunities and the right medium to get across their skills, their gifts, they will thrive in this world. It's up to us as a society to look at disability as something that should be portrayed with dignity and with strength. Having a villain with a disability, in my opinion, is not stereotyping, simply because you can portray a villain as having albinism. However, you can also portray a hero as having albinism. To me, it speaks of checks and balances, finding the right way of portraying a character, whether they have a disability or not. It can't just be one aspect of who they are taken to extremes. If you are logically balanced, if you say, this is a villain or a hero who just so happens to have a disability, and not exaggerating that trait to an excessive point, you can get a realistic portrayal. And that's why I think NOAA's petition was so important, that a person with albinism would be portrayed in something so well received is important. However, building up biases and stereotypes about any condition is not something we as a society should be encouraging. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.